The Incomparable, number 474, August 2019.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable, and it is the summer of Spider-Man. Did you know that? Did you not know that? Well, we did an episode about Spider-Man Far From Home, and we are now going to do three episodes about the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies from earlier in this century. That's right. And I have to do them soon, otherwise it'll become the fall of Spider-Man. I'll have to rename this the season of Spider-Man, and the season is defined by me and goes across many seasons. Anyway, hopefully we'll get these done before the seasons change, and it'll be the summer of Spider-Man, capped off by these three movies. Finally, at long last, Spider-Man properly comes to the big screen with his own little big screen movie spider adventure. And joining me to talk about the first serious foray of Spider-Man on the big screen are three wonderful people. Guy English is here. Hi, Guy.
Who am I? Are you sure you want to know?
Oh, boy. I asked. So I opened myself up for that one, didn't I?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked me that one first, because I was pretty sure somebody was going to steal that line. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Gene McDonald is also here. Hello.
Hello, Jason. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And Moises Chuyon is here.
Shazam!
There's multiple DC Comics references in this movie.
Yeah.
That was funny.
If somebody told you that this movie starts with a ponderous voiceover, somebody told the truth. Because that's how this movie starts, with Tobey Maguire as Peter Parker. This movie begins and ends with ponderous voiceovers. I have to admit, I, as a lifelong Spider-Man fan, I went into this movie, I was so excited that this movie was coming out, and it was right after we had had our daughter, and it was the first movie we ever took our daughter to. She was a baby.
Aww.
We had to keep her, you know, had to keep her asleep, which we managed to do. But it was like, you know, take a baby to a movie theater. It's like, you know, it's dangerous, but it's the Spider-Man movie. We have to go see it. And I was very excited by it, and I loved it, because it felt like they actually got, and we can talk about this, these like swinging on the webs and stuff. Like they got it. It seemed realistic and taken seriously, and it touches all of the kind of touchstones of the Spider-Man mythos. And I have to say, 17 years later, that baby, by the way, going off to college, I hadn't revisited it in a while. I saw it a lot, like the first 5 years, 10 years after it came out, but it's been a long time now, and we've been in this modern era of superheroes, and I was a little bit worried about revisiting it. And while there are things that I don't like about it, and things that I think that maybe the modern take on Spider-Man does better, I have to say I'm greatly relieved to report that at least my experience rewatching this overall was positive, that this movie does a lot of things right in a lot of smart ways. There are some ridiculous and silly things in it, but there are also a lot of things that that they did pretty well. And if you think about the era that this is in, this is before superhero movies were common. I did find it funny that now, from this level of remove, I see all of the things that it has in common with the Michael Keaton Batman movie, which is really interesting. Made 10, you know, 12 years earlier, but or 13 years earlier, but still, from this distance, it looks more similar to it, right down to the Danny Elfman score, than it did maybe back at the time. So I was pretty happy.
And at the same time, weirdly, it's got a Danny Elfman score, but not a great signature superhero theme song, which we didn't get until Michael Giacchino did a new twist on the classic, you know, Is He Strong? Listen, Bud, He's Got Radioactive Blood theme song.
Yeah. It's fine, but it's not iconic like the Batman score, certainly.
I think the ponderous voiceover works. It is ponderous. It is bad, but it makes it feel more like a self-important comic strip of the time that I think they're trying to invoke.
Yeah, there's no doubt that this movie is paying homage to the classic Stan Lee, Steve Ditko,
right.
and you want the narration, right, I guess, because of that. It's very comic booky. In fact, again, looking at it now, when is this movie set? It's set somewhere between 2002 and 1962.
It's set in the mid-1960s.
That's one of the funny things. Like, there are a lot of old-shaped cars in this, a lot of old-shaped taxi cabs.
A lot of phone booths. Like, he's phone like booths, putting yeah. quarters into phone booths mm-hmm. in 2002.
They're paying homage to the Lee and Ditko Spider-Man, and that means that it's going to feel older and almost period-like because of that. I bet you, in fact, Sam Raimi would have been happy to set this movie in the 60s, and the studio would not have been happy for them to make it a period piece. So instead, it is in this weird other world, like Batman from 1989.
There's a horror vibe going on to it. There's a bit of a like a this the sexual politics are very much yeah. out of the 80s. There's a bunch of stuff going on to it, which is of an 80s time that is trying to call back to the Stanley Ditko stuff, but is a little bit maybe more sexualized for the 80s, and yet we're presenting it in the 2000s. That I think has a little bit of a leap there, but. Ultimately, yeah. I can see the homage that they're paying, and it feels dated now.
Uh-huh. It's very much the Lee Ditko Spider-Man through the lens of the guy who made Evil Dead and Darkman.
Yep.
Right. Yeah.
No bones about it. Like, there's Sam Raimi's fingerprints all over it for good or ill. And frankly, 2002 was a different time in terms of sexual politics, in terms of some of the jokes that I had forgotten about. I'd forgotten about until uh-huh. they stuck out like a sore thumb, which we'll get to later.
I mean, I come to these things as the person who never read comic books, you know, certainly knew who Spider-Man was, but and probably watched cartoons with Spider-Man, but never, I'm the person, you know, I represent the vast majority of moviegoers who go anyway and want to see and make these things blockbuster big in their revenues. But I just remember seeing this in the theater really clearly because it was so like eye popping, you know, in so many ways and very exciting. And I was glad for me, it held up. Like I thought, oh, it's probably going to look crummy to me now. But honestly, I liked it a lot. And really after two summers of Avengers with mm-hmm. so much going on, I really appreciate it. Just like, you know, one superhero, one villain, and boom, you know, yeah. there's the yeah. story.
Right.
Yeah, I do admire that it for that, and it is a great template for these kind of movies.
I was a student programmer in college, and we were making the big back-to-school movie, a screening of Spider-Man, and people loved it. It was great. It was a good Spider-Man movie. It was a good superhero movie, and we, you know, people had not had one of that scale since Blade, and in the yep. mainstream, certainly since Superman.
And Batman, but keep in mind, this is the era where there were Batman sequels, and the Batman high of yeah. 1989 had long since been
oh boy,
spent, right? So,
yeah.
So it was a blockbuster, and people were relieved that it was actually an entertaining movie. It's not in the era that we live in now where there's just there are superhero movies everywhere.
At the time, there was not a lot of good stuff. There was maybe X-Men 1, 2?
Yes, actually X-Men came out before this.
Yeah, and this was a seminal movement in the superhero genre.
Right, so there's Batman and Robin in 1997, not good. X-Men
no.
in 2000, and then this movie. And then after this movie, there were X-Men sequels, and then, of course, there was Batman Begins, and then kind of Dark Knight and Iron Man a little bit after that. So it is not the strongest time, and this movie was a big hit. And like I said, as a lifelong Spider-Man fan, very excited to see Spider-Man. This does... We'll dive into it here. This movie does begin with a ponderous voiceover. As I said, I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of the way it's written. I'm not a fan of there's the whole, like, if somebody told you that there's this thing, if somebody told you this, then somebody lied. It's super pretentious. Yeah. I think it's bad writing. It doesn't bother me quite as much as the end voiceover does. Cause I think this movie, is really let down by the voiceover at the end and by the end in general. But the beginning, one of the things among many that bug me about the voiceover is it's got one of the least earned film noir-esque voiceovers ever, where yeah. he says, as usual, it's about a girl. It's not about a girl. It is not even remotely about a girl. That is not what the story is about. What are you doing, voiceover? It's like, I get that Peter Parker loves Mary Jane and his relationship with Mary Jane is part of this movie, but like the way it's phrased is so weird and it doesn't fit what the movie's about. So I hate it.
And it also, it makes the subtext of where Peter Parker's head is in retrospect, weirder than it did at the time, where at the time it was kind of like, oh, these are like caption boxes, thought balloons from the comics, mixed with a little bit of Sam Raimi, like 50s, 60s monster movie creature feature kind of stuff, which we see throughout the movie.
Right.
But in retrospect, looking back on it, it was kind of creepy and kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, Mary Jane in this story is nothing but an object of desire.
Even in the movie, the movie does play fair with it, because Harry is aware that Peter is in love with Mary Jane and won't interact with her. Harry encourages him to interact with her. He refuses. And then Harry uses all his lines and yeah, picks up on her. And it's that moment of like the movie saying, you got to talk to her. And then he attempts it, right? Badly, but he does attempt it. And then in a later moment, he actually does connect with her in a moment of humanity. So I feel like the movie core does the right thing. I can't sign on to the voiceover.
Kind of. Right.
Yeah, I want a cut of this movie that lacks most or all of the voiceover.
You want Ridley Scott to recut this without the...
It's a Blade Runner of Spider-Man
I want the Blade Runner final cut of Spider-Man.
There's a unicorn. He actually makes a unicorn out of a web at one point. You would not believe it.
It's weird. Eyes glow red and everybody's wondering if he's a spider or not. Moving past the voiceover though to the very quickly, this film does get us into getting Peter his powers with his trip to the science thing. We get a very quick interaction between Peter and Harry Osborn, played by James Franco, and Norman Osborn. So here he is. That's right. Willem Dafoe. I almost said Jesus himself. Anybody seen that movie?
Yeah.
Anyway, Willem Dafoe is here, and very quickly, in a very short set of exchanges, we get this. We get the idea that Peter's a science whiz, Harry is not, and Harry's dad is more engaged with the kid he just met because he likes science than he is with his own son, and is probably not a very good dad. And it's done in a very, again, it's short. It's movie shorthand, but I thought it was. It's very effective. Like, you know where these three characters are. Let's move on and go to the spiders, and that's what this movie does. And then we're in the science museum, like right after that, which is
I love those
effective
beats. They are beat for beat. Especially after this, Peter starts to get his powers. The goblin starts to get his powers. We are introduced to Jesus as evil Jesus.
Peter says he doesn't seem so bad, and Harry says, "Well, that's because he's not your father." And it's like it says so much, right? Like obviously Harry complains about his dad all the time, and Peter finally meets him, and he's like, "Oh, well, he likes me." And Harry's like, "Yeah, well, that's because you're not me." And we move on.
It sets everything up. It plows ahead. I think it does an amazing job at carrying what the essential weights of these characters are within the first, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. It's rolling fast.
We get a number of comic book things trotted out as expositional dialogue by the person touring them through the lab.
I have to say, I didn't notice it quite as much when I first watched this movie as I did this time, because I was paying attention to the main part of it. But the speech that the lady gives in the science museum, she's literally listing Spider-Man's powers and describing them to various kinds of spiders. And the capper is, he says, "We've mixed all of the powers together in one genetic spider, and now this spider is and we have 15 of them, or 14 and it made me laugh because it is, if you listen carefully to her speech, she's just literally she's enumerating Spider-Man's powers. That is what this movie is doing.
Did you notice that she specifically rejects the Miles Morales the power of being able to blend in with your environment?
She at one point says, "If you will, a spider sense," in one of those moments of like, okay, I see what you're doing now, thank you for doing that. But we get, you know, Harry interacts with Mary Jane, and Peter finally decides he's gonna interact with Mary Jane. He wants to take her picture for the school paper. This is Kirsten Dunst, who is actually, I think, several years younger than any of the other so-called teenagers in this movie. I think she was actually a teenager when they shot this movie.
Yeah, there are a lot of middle-aged teenagers.
There are a lot of mid-20s teenagers here, but I think she was 19 when she shot this.
Yeah, he was 27, Tobey Maguire, and she was 20.
Yeah, and I think James Franco was like 24,
Tobey Maguire was almost old enough to run for president.
Yeah, his hairline's getting pushed back there. Peter's really passive-aggressive.
super
at this point, right? Like we don't, because and this is all building up, because this is the first time it would be told again in a later movie that we get the complete Spider-Man origin story. But Spider-Man's origin story is not that he kills a guy. His origin story is that he passively allows a criminal to escape when he should have been active, right? And so Peter's aggression here is all passive aggression. It's all, I don't want to hurt you, Flash, but I'll defend myself. You know, I'll stand up to you. I won't try to disengage with you, but I'm also not going to come out and be the aggressor. And then that leads him to that moment where he lets the robber past who goes and kills his Uncle Ben. So that's definitely what they're trying to go for here, yeah, is that he's not starting the fights, he's finishing them.
Spider-Man was born out of a willful decision not to engage.
Yep, 100%.
Batman was born out of the inability to engage.
Yep.
And I think that is sort of informs the two characters, right? Like, Batman is just hell-bent on always fighting against his ability that he always wants to do better. And Spider-Man, I think, is informed by the notion that if he doesn't try his best, something bad will happen.
Yeah, he can't stay on the sidelines.
Right, exactly. Those are two very different notions, mm-hmm, right? One is basically angry and born out of his own failure, and the other one is born out of an understanding that if he ever fails himself, bad things may happen.
Yeah.
And one of them is inspiring, and one of them's sort of basically terrifying. And I think that was those are distinct characteristics. And I, you know,
yep.
And it's why ultimately I find Spider-Man a more uplifting character, and one that I wish more people would aspire to be as you know, just in day to day life.
Well, he's definitely, I mean, this is something that I think maybe the broader pop culture doesn't understand quite as well, and maybe they do, I don't know. But it's like Spider-Man is the everyman who is sort of, yeah, forced by circumstance to be a hero, right? You've got the great, mm-hmm, power, you have to be a hero, yes, now, and his life sucks, right? Like and you're supposed to identify with him. That was the brilliance of Lee and Ditko when they created Spider-Man in an era where their competition was all these superheroes who were perfect in so many ways, that Spider-Man was a sad sack. He was a schlub. Right. He did it because he had to, but everybody hated him for it. Like, that's the magic of Spider-Man. He's not a perfect hero at all.
Spider-Man is just a guy that wants to take a picture.
It's a poor sucker. Yep.
Yeah.
Got bit by it. And in fact, yeah, he just wanted to take a picture and he got bit by a spider. It makes him real sleepy. And so he has to go home and crash. We will check up with him later, but first, let's see what Norman Osborn is up for. He's feeling a lot of financial pressures and decides that he's going to perform human experiments on himself in order to get a military contract. And my notes about Norman Osborn at this point are, you know, they kind of want, I don't know, do they want us to feel this way or not? But it's like Norman Osborn. They kind of want us to feel sympathy for him, that you get this split personality later in the movie between him and the Green Goblin. But I got to be clear, Norman Osborn is a maniac from the beginning, yep, in this movie. Because, yes, he's like, you know, before he takes the serum, he's already a maniac. He's already, you know, Dr. Strom, get out of here. I'm gonna inject myself. I don't really care what you say.
He drinks from the vial and throws it like he's Thor in a bar.
There's broken glass everywhere. I think my family formulated a theory, by the way, because Dr. Strom gets thrown through a pane of glass and lands on a computer and he's found dead the next day. Our theory is he was fine until he got some of that broken glass from that vial, and that was what did it for him. It's a shame, but like, who is this guy? He's a maniac before he gets magic green gas goblin powers.
So the thing that bothers me about this is that it's something that tracks with a very old school way of classifying villains as, well, mental illness equals villain, where like split personality, the proper clinical definition of it doesn't really matter. But the split personality thing is an element of what it is that makes him, you know, Jekyll and Hyde bad. And it's something that you don't need to be the the reason why somebody does bad stuff. For my money, the thing that makes Norman Osborn bad and the primary motivation that kind of gets lost when they use the Jekyll and Hyde thing, where there really is a good Norman on the inside.
There's
in the same way that I'm not going to name any billionaires and make any billionaires mad at the Incomparable podcast, but the same way that billionaires say, I'm going to save the world by spending billions and billions of dollars on something that doesn't functionally save lives, reverse, greenhouse gases. Like, he is all about ego. He is all about having the big achievement. He is all about being the big man. It's all big man syndrome kind of stuff at the end of the day. The aspect of him, being somehow mentally ill and there's a good guy inside him somewhere. Sorry, that doesn't work for me.
First of all, Willem Dafoe, definitely just makes this movie so much fun to watch. He doesn't seem like a nice guy, even though he's nice to Peter Parker when he meets him. Otherwise, he's mean to his son, and he's obviously an unscrupulous industrialist. He's just saying all these things that we hear in real life of saying, like, well, only one test went bad. The other ones were great. We're going with that. And trying to justify keeping these military contracts when obviously what they're doing is dangerous, as we learn. But, so I did feel weird when it was like trying to make it explicit that there were two people, because really it didn't track for me. I mean, I liked watching that because it was cool, but and that feeling that there was like this, this Mr. Hyde ready to come out was, even under the surface in a few scenes, that was kind of cool acting, on Willem Dafoe's part, but it didn't totally make sense that there was a nice guy or a decent person in the mix, because there really wasn't.
I get why Sam Raimi, like you said, Gene, the drama of that scene where he's talking to himself in the mirror, that's great. It is classic. It is a kind of a classic horror movie kind of thing. It is a Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing. I get it. But yeah, Norman Osborn seems like an awful person from the start. So unless they're saying, well, now the Green Goblin, we've taken the good part of him and made a good personality too, that is powerless. And I almost would rather him just have been, amped up on all the things that made him bad in the first place, instead of giving him a little bit of an emotional arc where he's struggling with the fact that he's awful and a murderer, because I don't know. It makes for good. It's a good scene, but I don't really believe that Norman was ever a good guy. All right. So in the next little chunk of the movie, it's the Peter gets powers thing. He wakes up. They did the special effect equivalent of what they would later do with Chris Evans, where they show Chris Evans being a skinny guy. They show the non-pumped up Tobey Maguire in that one shot with the shirt off, so that then you can see that Tobey Maguire worked out in the morning when he discovers that he doesn't need glasses and he's got muscles and he can stick to things. He discovers that he can spin webs, which was controversial, of course, because classic Spider-Man made little web shooters, but they don't go that route. He actually exudes webs from his body. Ooh, gross. He's got a spider sense, which we see in a scene that is, that really overdoes it in terms of would you like to see a spitball very slowly launched in the air? It gets the scene, the idea across, and then it keeps going for quite a while. But that is all happening at the school, and then afterward, where he's figuring out his powers. And this is, this is a classic superhero stuff, discovering that you have powers and you're special, leading to the great moment where he figures out how to shoot webs very slowly by shouting, "Go web, Shazam, up, up and away web," and then finally figures out what he needs to do and then slams into the wall of a building. And
I'm not sure that back in 2002 you could take all of the shortcuts that we expect today.
Oh, I agree.
I think that we should have had the origin story. I think we should have had this experimenting with your powers moment. I think that him catching MJ and all of the food on the tray was good. I think him...
The moment where he walks out of the cafeteria and the tray sticks to the door is so funny.
Love it. Right. It's so great. And it's a very Sam Raimi horror movie-esque moment. Like that's a very Sam Raimi thing, and I think it's great. What is called out to be, what you called out to be an overwrought Spidey sense moment is, I think, a necessary visual depiction of what he's actually sensing, because you can't just draw a bunch of squiggles on his head.
I know. I just think it goes on too long, because you end up being like, there's a paper airplane. There's a guy shooting out a spit wad from a straw. And like, it just feels like it goes on too long.
Yeah, but if you didn't know.
Yeah, I get you. I just, it seems a bit much.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't know. I don't know what the editing should have been, because guess what? I've known him for, I don't know, since I was 4 years old. So, I don't know, 1978, basically. But so I don't know. I can't judge that. But it felt like it conveyed the notion of him being very aware of everything in his environment very well. And then when he just starts dodging the punches, that's killer. I don't know how they don't peg him as being Spider-Man immediately, because that's a little
that,
bit
that
over
is
the
something
top.
That came up in our family was yeah. How do they not know that? Oh, we have this kid who has incredible reflexes
can flip over
and
two
can
guys.
Flip.
The excitement that he has over the powers is just fun compared to the other superheroes we're talking about. You know, to just be sort of like whooping his head off about like, look at what I can do. You know, just to himself and being excited. I thought that was cool.
So MJ seemed upset.
She was pissed. Yeah.
I can understand that, because he went way overboard. Like, he didn't know what he was doing. But I mean, you can't punch somebody 20 feet back and feel good about that. Like, that's broken ribs, and that's not good. So.
Even though he didn't start the fight, it was, you know, an outrageous thing where he's pushing those guys around and hurting them.
Yeah. Which is where Uncle Ben goes in soon.
Yeah, so I want to talk about Uncle Ben. Cliff Robertson is Uncle Ben in this. I think he's great. I think that there are a couple good film Uncle Bens. There are some weird dialogue things in here that, again, I wonder quite where they're going. The thing that I've never understood is the exchange where Peter says, "Don't start painting without me," and he says, "Well, don't start up with me." And the way he says it is weird. I guess he's like, don't start to fight with me or something. It's this super weird exchange. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? It's so strange. And then of course he doesn't paint after all.
It's so colloquial. Like, I have to think it must be like colloquial Michigander kind of
speak. I don't know what it is. It just doesn't, it's nonsensical to me. It's like, I mean, the way they phrase it is like, "Hey, Uncle Ben, da da da. Oh, Peter, da da da." Except the words don't make any sense.
Yeah, it feels like they're speaking a different universe's version of American
English.
Don't
start up with me.
I don't understand the words.
Okay, I won't.
I took it to be like, "Hey, don't start without me." And he was saying, "Don't start with me," as in like, Peter's basically saying like, "Okay, hey, I'll be there." And Ben is saying like, "Okay, look, I know you're going to be late, so Don't lay it on thick. Like, don't lie to me. Don't, like, come on. We know it."
Well, don't start with me. Yeah.
I get your interpretation. You've correctly interpreted the weird thing he says that is not a phrase anyone has ever said before. But yes, okay. I do agree with your interpretation of it.
Yeah, what I'll say is that there's not just a thread, but there are multiple argument discussion threads about what this is supposed to mean, where people just cannot understand.
I googled it all this time, and it's like nobody really understands what this is. It's weird.
Interesting.
Okay, I retract that. I reversed engineered that entirely from the film.
Guy, so. Don't start up with me.
Guy, that's right.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay, now I take it. Sure.
Yeah. Nice. So we do get a good scene with Peter and MJ. Her father is awful and yells at her mom and her and is verbally abusive at least, and perhaps physically abusive as well. So Peter ends up walking out to take the trash out, and she walks out there, and they have that conversation where they actually talk to each other like human beings. And Peter is very supportive of her, and "You're going to be great." And he's not creepy at all. He's actually like, "You're great. You're going to do well. I'm super supportive of you." And it's a really sweet scene that ends, by the way, with her, with Flash calling her out to take a ride in his car. And I think that a nice bit of writing and a nice thing that Kirsten Dunst does with the performance too is multiple times in this movie we see Mary Jane being secretly miserable, and then in a heartbeat, using those acting skills that she's got, watch out Broadway, turning around and acting like everything's great and she's super bubbly and happy. And we see her before where she's actually miserable. And in that moment where she runs out to the car.
She's putting on an act. Right.
And this is a great example of what we were saying earlier about how if you delete creepy voiceover Peter, this scene plays great. It plays absolutely great. And she asks, you know, what he's going to do after high school. And mentally, I thought, well, probably the same thing any other middle-aged teenager is going to do after high school. Go work at the steel mill. Uh-huh. I don't know. But there is a nice, sweet relationship there. Again, if you retcon voiceover Peter out of your mind.
There was a bit of creepiness there, though.
Well, like the thing where he said, "You were so awesome. And Cinderella, you made me cry." And she says, that was like fourth grade.
It was first grade, which makes it, actually, fourth grade would make it creepy. First grade makes it a little bit more adorable.
No, I think it's just that she has always been this sunny, beautiful girl who lives next door who's amazing. And she's never really noticed him or taken him for granted or whatever it is. And I don't view it as creepy as much as it is like he knows he's her biggest fan and he knows everything about her. Oh God, that sounds creepy. But no, like,
yeah, it does sound creepy.
But when he talks, I don't take it as she's ever been
an object of desire for him so much as the subject of his affection.
It's both, right? It really is both.
I think there's something to being totally fine with being friends with someone who you admire and that you are interested in. And again, you take voiceover Peter out of the equation. And actual Peter never crosses any boundaries. And to your point, Guy, I think even without voiceover Peter, there is a little bit of, I've been tracking all of your movements. They've been fabulous.
He is super awkward and says things that he shouldn't.
Yeah. I don't know if you've met me, Jason.
I think it's both. I actually think that this is one of the challenges of this screenplay. And the way it views this character is
the sexual politics of the 60s.
Yeah, because Peter is really supportive of her in a good way, and yet intertwined with that is that she's his dream girl and he wants to ask her out and all of that. And you kind of can't you kind of can't get away with the fact that it's doing both. Mm-hmm. It just is. It is both because she is the object of his desire in the end, and it's a story about a girl. That's what he said at the top.
But it's not about the girl, it's about his desire for a girl.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you get that scene later on, too, where he's like, oh, I was just in the neighborhood. Then, you know, says immediately, well, you know, it took me 2 buses and 1 cab ride to get to this neighborhood, but now I'm in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that's a little weird to do. They don't really have a friendship, right?
He discloses that, which is nice, and he's there to be supportive, which is nice, but he also did
But it is also...
he's also a creepy stalker, so, you know. All right, so Peter decides, because Flash has a fancy car, that he wants a fancy car, and there's a super wacky montage where he thinks about cars. There is some wacky dialogue in this section of the movie where, at one point, he fills his room with webs, and Aunt May says, "You're acting a bit strange, Peter," to which he replies, "Okay, thanks," and closes the door, which is hilarious because what is that?
Aunt May almost exists in a parallel universe across the bleed of which all of her, she has this beautifully melodic voice and these very comic 1960s style comic book pep talk kind of things that she says. And well, you know, what you have to keep in mind is this and this and this. I'm your wise old aunt and blah, 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 blah. Okay, cool. All right, bye. And it's almost like they don't really directly communicate. It's a very one-way communication where Aunt May is saying all this lovely stuff and Peter's just kind of he's almost non-responsive to what she's saying.
Yeah, I think it's very funny that she's trying to be a parent and see what the heck is going on with him. Anyway, let's do some wrestling, shall we? Octavia Spencer will check you in for your wrestling match, by the way. Just another person.
Yes, I love that. It's like, what? I forgot about that.
Randy Savage is Bonesaw. Bruce Campbell,
Bonesaw,
of course.
Bonesaw is ready.
Bruce Campbell from Sam Raimi's Evil Dead movies is the announcer who, when given a really dumb name for Spider-Man, he says, "It's the Amazing Spider-Man instead. That's not my name." He's going to get $3,000 for 3 minutes.
And Peter's upset that it's that he changes the name.
Also, I should mention this is also where we get the payoff of the montage where Peter shows his skill as an artist and draws a flawless, amazing Spider-Man costume, and you're like, oh, he's gonna make a costume, and then we see it here, and it's crap. It's a sweatshirt and a hood.
Yeah, I kind of love it.
It's so funny. He's put in a cage match, but he can handle Randy Macho Man Savage as Bonesaw. After getting beat up a little bit, he kicks him down and gets the money, except he only gets paid $100 because what a ripoff from this jerk. And the guy gets robbed because
you got to last 3 minutes.
The wrestling promoter is just like sitting in a room with money, counting it and stuff. It's like, what? Anyway, he's robbed.
The promoter gets robbed by bleached hair, dollar store brand Robert De Niro.
Yeah. And so Peter lets him leave because the guy just didn't pay him what he was owed, he feels. And so he's going to let the guy get robbed. And of course, the classic is that this is the guy who then goes, and in this case, he carjacks Uncle Ben, steals the car, shoots Uncle Ben, and Uncle Ben dies, and it's very sad. Of course, Peter's last words to Uncle Ben were mean, that he wasn't his real father. It's very sad. But there's a car chase. Peter sort of figures out how to swing on webs through buildings like Spider-Man, which is really kind of fun to see. There's a lot of logic put into that about like, how does swinging on webs in tall buildings work? And how would you, and he has to, you see him figure it out as he's going, ah, and I think it's really good and really smart.
Yeah. One of the better points of the movie is that they kind of stick to that logic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you see it doesn't work, and then he finally kind of figures out, it's like, you got to swing down, and then you do another web, and then you swing along, and then he's figured it out, and he end up reaching the robber and cornering him in a building. Yeah.
To be fair to the visual effects of 2002, the earlier scenes where he's jumping from rooftop to rooftop don't look so great.
Yeah.
They didn't look so great at the time. Like, I remember nitpicking about it where I was like, could they have maybe set it at night? Like, could they have set it at night was a thing for visual effects of this era, where there are certain things that they, like this web swinging thing looks so much better because they're doing it at night and they're able to hide a lot more.
And also, I feel like there's something real about this physics that is not real about a regular human body suddenly leaping long distances, where it's like, even if you had great CGI, like, how do you make that look not ridiculous? Because,
well, Jason,
it's impossible.
It's the natural ability of a spider to look lifted by invisible wires.
I see. So in this case, I think the swinging does come across a lot better. I will say something that happens several times in this movie that really bugs me happens here, where he catches the robber, and we immediately flash back to literally the previous scene in the movie for several moments to make it clear that this is the same guy that just ran past him. Literally 3 minutes ago in the movie.
The audience is so dumb. Previously on 5 minutes ago.
No, but wait a minute, though. We needed it because that was his realization that it was the same person. He didn't know that until that point.
There's a lot, awful lot of flashback there for his realization, I would say. I would say, I get what they're doing. It's too much. There's too much of it here. There's like so many. And Peter, throughout this movie, keeps hearing dialogue played from earlier scenes, played back to remind him of a thing that just happened in the movie. And it's just like, come on. Come on, movie.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, I should say I really like this movie. I still like this movie. There are things like that storytelling choice. And in this same zone of the movie, jumping back to Bonesaw, when Peter says, did your husband make it for you?
Man.
And we suddenly get the amazingly homophobic Spider-Man. Oh, my God. I'd completely forgotten about that.
Yeah.
It's not good.
There's stuff like that that I feel like, even though I like the movie, I think it's very fair to look at it as, oh, well, that certainly has not aged well.
So next up, the Green Goblin kills a bunch of generals and defense contractors.
You would think that would have a bigger effect on national security, and maybe some people would be paying attention to this.
We get a smash or a very clever match cut between the things blowing up to mortar boards from a graduation ceremony being thrown in the air, which is very nice. And this is the point where Spider-Man learns to make a costume, and he makes a really, really great one, showing lots of skills. Maybe if his art career that he can do from his amazing illustrations doesn't work out, he can make costumes and be a tailor, because he is amazing at it. We also get we get a montage of New York, and Spider-Man is on the case, and people are learning that Spider-Man's out there, including a bunch of guys at Ground Zero, because this is a just after 9/11 movie, and so they have a bunch of guys in hard hats at Ground Zero saying that Spider-Man is great.
That's the scene that I think was added after, because the trailer had Spider-Man catching a helicopter after bank heist.
Between the Twin Towers.
And what you get instead is you get the guys at Ground Zero, you get the shot with him with the American flag at the top of a skyscraper, you get the scene with New Yorkers later that it feels like it was added on about, like, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us, all of that.
Loved
and
it.
My Every personal favorite it. Person yeah. it, on the ground in this entire movie is the guy who says, he stinks and I don't like him.
I don't like him. Comedian Jim Norton.
Yeah,
it's great.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay, the Daily Bugle. Remember the Daily Bugle? J.K. Simmons, and by the way, Elizabeth Banks is Betty Brant. Yeah.
And Do the Right Things, Radio Raheem himself, Bill Nunn
as Robbie Robertson. Yeah, absolutely. So we learn the Daily Bugle. We get a whole thing throughout this movie of Peter. It's that classic thing where Peter gets some money by taking pictures of himself as Spider-Man, and then which leads to some funny back and forth with J. Jonah Jameson. He praises freelancing and also says that he'll send him some meat at Christmas, which is hilarious. And can we just stop to say, years before Robert Downey Jr. was perfect comic book casting as Tony Stark, J.K. Simmons was perfect comic book casting as J. Jonah Jameson.
No, the casting of this newsroom is impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
It's so well done. Everybody, like Betty, from Betty Brant to like Radio Raheem, everything is just killer.
Yep.
Like that
It feels like a newsroom from 1985, not 2002, but...
Again, yes, it's true. It's true. Get the newspaper stuff in there while you can. Well, they wanted to use the classic stuff, so they use it, even though it doesn't necessarily make sense anymore.
No, but it was amazing. Every one of those characters was great. They didn't really interact with the main cast or the main story at all, but they made that movie in a lot of ways. Like that, those punchlines were great.
So the Daily Bugle also is, you know, I think it owes a debt to the Superman movie with the Daily Planet, where it's like, and obviously they both owe a debt to like the front page. This is the where do you find fast talking dialogue where people are like zinging and saying funny stuff so fast that you got to wind the tape back to understand what they said. Well, you go to a newspaper, and that's where that dialogue is ever since His Girl Friday, right? So here it is with JJ and his crew, and it's hilarious. And J.K. Simmons is talking so fast, and it's all very funny.
Everybody's talking on deadline.
I particularly appreciate it that they managed to insert a little tutorial on the difference between slander and libel.
That's so good, right?
Because
he's like a clown, and he's like, you know, J. Joe Jameson, he's got all snappy dialogue, and he's like, who is this guy? And then suddenly, he's the editor-in-chief. That's Journalism Law 101 there, folks. All journalism students need to
take it. J. Jonah Jameson has been sued for both many times.
He knows all about the ins and outs of First Amendment law. Okay, a scene I want to mention, we're about to get to a lot of action in this movie, but a scene I want to mention before we get there is something we alluded to earlier. It is when Peter runs into MJ at the diner. And the reason I wanted to mention it, so she reveals she's going out with Harry, which he's rooming with Harry. Super awkward that this is going on. We saw it be set up, but that's not what I want to talk about as much as I want to talk about the fact that she is embarrassed that she's working at a diner and not on Broadway. And Peter... But going back to Peter as the supportive guy, I would take it a step further here and say this is Peter as a working class hero, because his attitude to her is, you're working. Work is dignity. There's no indignity in having a job. That really struck me this time, that is Peter's worldview here, is it doesn't matter to him that you're not famous on Broadway. You've got a job and you shouldn't be ashamed of working, because... You know, and I'm like, that is one of the appeals of this character, is that he is this working class hero. He is a guy who is not privileged, and he has great sympathy for somebody else who's, you know, working a backbreaking job in heels, by the way, that you should never, ever, ever work a diner shift in.
Yeah, why is she wearing kitten heels working in a diner?
That's a key rookie mistake there.
You're right. And the fact that her boss comes out to give her crap, and that's how he finds out.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's cool with it, right? He's like, no, that's, I mean, you just very much, it's like, you got a job. That's,
yeah.
Don't be ashamed of it.
He's cool with it. He's supportive and it's like, oh, I see what you want and I see that you're not,
yeah, you're gonna
happy
do great
with what you've got.
I'm
but
team
you know
MJ.
What? I don't care. Like you, I,
but you're doing what you need to do. You're doing what you
exactly.
have to do.
Right.
And this is the thing. This is the thing that makes this progression to the Peter Parker that we believe in and that we like growing into that person works for me. It's the work they didn't do in the Man of Steel, where the thing is, oh, he's figuring out how to become Superman, and then he becomes somebody who doesn't care about selflessness. This is Peter Parker honing in on that crucial Peter Parker stuff. And this is what makes the movie still work for me. You know, again, despite quibbles and nitpicks throughout, the core of the character is still there. And this is where that really starts to lock in best.
Yep.
So here's the thing. I love this scene. I love that Peter is shown to have more compassion and more understanding and more wanting to see success. I think MJ feels she's had. At the same time, is this not just diminishing MJ?
I don't know. I think part of it is this is an act shift in the movie because they're now trying to make it in the city. But I feel like this is her. We need to know where she is and what she's doing. And she's struggling and they're all kind of struggling in this new world. So I don't think it diminishes her. I mean, she's embarrassed by where she is. She gives him the opportunity to diminish her and then he refuses. I think that's the important part. Okay, action stuff to talk about now. The Green Goblin appears. We got the two suits. This is going to be a recurring issue. One of the things that struck me about the Spider-Man outfit is that while the outfit looks pretty good, you know, they chose to have, rather than like the spiderweb lines on the costume, that they're like raised spiderweb kind of above the costume. It's like a little like puffy 3D kind of thing there. And it's got this classic Spider-Man eyes. It does remind me that one of the great things that they did in the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Spider-Man is have the expressive eyes, because of course the comic eyes of Spider-Man are expressive. And the reality is that if you just have a guy in a mask, the eyes are completely not expressive. And you see that here, where there are moments where the Green Goblin and Spider-Man are conversing with each other, where Spider-Man's face doesn't move at all. You can't tell. He might as well not be talking. And the Green Goblin, if you're watching in HD on a properly calibrated TV, you might see his mouth occasionally. And at one point, he does pop his little eye things off just so you can see his eyes, really. But at many points, it's like, and forgive me for saying this, I've said this before, it's like a Power Rangers episode where you have people in inexpressive masks and there's dialogue. And I guess these characters are saying this dialogue, but who can really tell?
Jason, this is a single thing that ruins the movie. No, it's not a joke. There's a reason that Iron Man pops his mask every time. There's a reason
the bomb goes off and exposes half of Peter's face at the end of this movie, yep. Right? Is they want him to be expressive. And the funny thing is, in HD, this is the first time I've seen this movie in HD. I saw it in the movie theater, and then I've seen it on home video. In HD, you can see Willem Dafoe's mouth some of the time as the Green Goblin, and it helps a little bit. It's not quite as bad, but Peter, when Spider-Man is talking, seriously, you can't tell that there's anybody moving a mouth back there. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where they wanted to be so, with Spider-Man, they want to be so devoted to rendering this character properly, and then you like, we're going to treat them like real characters in the real world, and then you get a scene between the Green Goblin and Spider-Man, and you're like, oh god, no, it's just two masks.
That scene on the rooftop is that should be gone. That should be gone and recut. I think at that point I don't think Goblin quite understands who he is talking to yet, but refigure that, because that needs to be done with the masks off.
It's one of those things that it hurts.
You've got Willem Dafoe.
I know.
How do you take Willem Dafoe and put him behind a goofy
green Halloween mask?
One of the costume concepts which they used in the PlayStation game as like an alternate outfit or something for him, was with an expressive face and this like shaggy, torn kind of black cloak kind of a thing that almost made him look more like Corvus Glaive from Avengers Infinity War and Endgame, where he's got this like long, like knee length, shaggy, ragged edged cloak. And you could actually see the face make expressions, but they make this metaphorical thing of the masks and masks and masks and masks. And it's almost like they're trying to cover up the fact that they're going to be completely expressionless.
There's a reason that Tony Stark has always been able to pop his mask open.
Yeah.
And guess what? It's because I'm willing to go out on a limb here and say that they watched this movie and they thought, hey, we're paying an actor, a great actor, a lot of money. Why don't we see his face? Why don't we just see his face? Call me crazy. Maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah, and that's why in superhero movies, people's masks get blown off all the time, right?
Exactly.
Because you need to see if they're completely masked, you've got to have it. Another moment that, and again, I'm gonna nitpick this movie with some love because I really was worried that I wasn't going to like this upon rewatch, and I really liked it. There are lots of things that are dated about it, but I think it's a really fun movie. One of the things that I love about this movie, only ironically, is the Unity Day Festival, which is, or as I like to call it, the Hooray for Everyone Festival. It is a festival put on featuring Macy Gray to say yay for the world. It is brought to you by the Military Industrial Complex because it's hosted by Oscorp. So it is therefore the Military Industrial Complex brings you World Unity Day. Okay, that's a problem. And then they've got balloons and stuff. And it's just like, it is the dumbest thing. But they got to get a bunch of people to have a crowd, to have it be in jeopardy. And it makes me laugh every time because it's the 1-2 punch of the World Unity Festival. And then, ladies and gentlemen, Macy Gray will perform a song from the soundtrack for 10 seconds before she's interrupted by the Green Goblin. And there's a delightful shot as the Green Goblin is flying in where you actually see Macy Gray stop singing and look up and be terrified by the Green Goblin. That it makes me laugh every time.
It was a very specific era of corporate synergy movie studios that also owned record labels would go, okay, who do we need to throw into this movie to artificially boost their single sales?
And I want to be clear,
attached to the soundtrack.
I found it stupid and goofy in 2002. I mean, it was stupid and goofy at the time. It remains stupid and goofy.
It is stupid and goofy. At this point, if you told me World Unity Day,
World Unity Day, hooray for everyone, up with people,
I would be like, yeah, maybe I'm with
here,
you.
Here, Raytheon,
Jason, maybe,
Jason,
I don't know.
Jason, I forget which one is the one in May, Unity Day or Life Day?
Life Day's in August, I believe.
August, well, okay. Raytheon
and General Electric are going to put on a peace festival.
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm getting at is, you know, World Unity Day may not be what you think it is.
Stark Industries says World Unity Day. Yeah.
Even if they were trying to do something that was like kind of silly, it wasn't very strong in its execution either. Like it didn't really feel like, oh, haha. You know, it was more like, what the heck?
There's some crowds. There's some balloons.
So to be honest, I would believe this is another a quick rewrite after the events of 9/11.
Yeah.
And the World Unity Day was like, they were going to have some kind of festival and they needed to make it like, okay, well, let's repurpose that to be something good and you know, happy.
The reason I think that isn't the case is that this was an action set piece going back far enough that they were able to manufacture a toy playset thing of it. Because among the weird merchandising of this movie,
I'm
saying is that there was really weird merchandising of this movie where Sony made this extremely not posable, like 12-inch Spider-Man doll. And then there was a playset that was like Mary Jane falling off of the balcony with the Green Goblin that nobody bought. There were like four different things from the movie that they actually made. People say rewrites or like reshoots. This was not something that was added in reshoots. They might have reshot part of it.
I think you just need a different framing. There was like one line that said it's a World Unity Day.
I wondered, watching it, and the fact that they're in the action set piece that happens here, Spider-Man bounces off of a bunch of balloons, if this was originally supposed to be the Thanksgiving parade.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
And it got changed to this totally bogus World Unity Day thing where there are balloons that just don't go anywhere. They just are in Times Square, I guess, to be there. Mm. Look, why are we analyzing? It's the dumbest thing in the movie. Let's just say it's this dumb thing. Macy Gray makes a product placement appearance. And then there's a fight. There's a pumpkin bomb that turns you into skeletons, which is, you know.
Pumpkin bombs make a lot more sense at a Thanksgiving festival.
I suppose they do. Also, pumpkins and skeletons, they go together. It's a great Halloween thing. The pumpkin bomb makes you into a skeleton. Great. Yeah. That's the end of the rest of the... Norman Osborn is killing so many generals and board members of military industrial complex companies.
I really question... That's the thing that I found myself thinking in the back of my head, headcanon-wise, was I think we don't have any five-star generals left.
No.
And it's odd that there's no response to this from the U.S. government.
Well, it is. It's all happening off screen somewhere. But Norman, yes, is killing all of the generals. And yet they're still allowing them to go to the World Unity Festival because it's being put on by their key military contractors. Anyway, it's a good scene where Spider-Man has to navigate some stuff and protect Mary Jane and
it is a great scene.
Bounce off the balloons and he damages the glider enough that the Green Goblin basically says, "Curse you, Spider-Man, I'll get you next time." It's like super hokey, super villain dialogue, and he swings and drops her off on a rooftop where there's like a man and woman canoodling on their fancy top of a rooftop swimming pool skyscraper thing, and Spider-Man just sort of swings in with a girl and says, she's going to use the elevator, and takes off.
I love that scene. He's not cheesy. He's just corny. Do you know what I mean? Like he's not trying anything. He's just like, "Hey, I'm glad I saved your life. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
By the way, everybody, this woman's going to..." You know,
yeah, no, he's trying to be elevator. Mr. Cool. Hey, I'm Spider-Man.
Yeah,
and he's super nervous because it's Mary Jane. He's like, "No, it's..."
Yeah,
it's
I know. I kind of like that. I kind of like that he's nervous in and outside of the mask. He's just the same idiot dude.
Yep.
So, yeah, I kind of like it. He's still a goof.
J. Jonah Jameson, there's a great line from J.K. Simmons. It's, these weirdos all got to have a name now. that's good. Names of the Green Goblin. But we end up, he bashes in, and Spider-Man, Peter does a quick change and they fight again. And not my favorite dialogue from the Green Goblin here, because he does the Emperor thing. He's like, you and I are not so different. Think about it, hero. Join me and we could rule this Empire State as father and son. It's not great. But he does save Mary Jane and in the rain, and we get the upside down kiss that this movie is famous for, where
everybody knows that, and I think that's something worth noting.
Yeah.
That's a real Spider-Man moment.
It really is. It really is.
I mean, you know, Batman's not going to give an upside down kiss.
Definitely
he may
not.
Bite somebody when he's upside down, but he's not going to give them a kiss. And
I always think about how like noses will get in the way of that, but then I'm like, no, it's very romantic and iconic, and I should not think about the logistics of kissing somebody while hanging from a web upside down.
Jason, a lot of people made fun of this in various parodies around the time. I think it's okay to consider it little...
Over the test of time, the reason that people have made fun of it and all that is that it just sticks with you. Like, it is an iconic moment. It is.
Yeah,
it's great.
It really is. Yeah. Also, you'll pass out after 45 seconds. Just telling you.
All right. Spiders kiss upside down all the time, guy. I don't know what you're talking about. That's one of the powers of a spider. To kiss upside down.
I'm not in great shape, but I mean, like all that blood going to your head. I mean, it's not good.
One of the things, you know, Guy brought up earlier about the gender politics of this stuff is you know, as nice and sweet and lovely as it is, it still calls back to this damseling of the main female character in the narrative.
She's always kind of in danger.
She's in a very wet dress that's not great. And the
You know, she is an object. She is a thing. She is not as much of a person as she is a plot device. And it's one of the reasons that I'm glad that
she's a target for like four or five rapists, which is,
yeah. Yeah. Like everything is rape danger. And it's one of the reasons that admittedly the MCU Spider-Man movies still have not really worked on gender parity as well as I think they could have, and as much as I think they should, and I hope that they do. Mm-hmm. They've done a much better job at making the roles for female characters in those movies more than just a person to be rescued. There is more than a plot purpose behind these women.
A lot of stuff since then, you know, is, you know, finding women who are badass and, you know, can kick butt and take care of themselves. That wasn't so much a thing back then. And now it's like, you know, it's half of what's on streaming video and or in the movies, as characters that, you know, women can relate to and feel like, yeah, you know, and fist bump over, you know, Captain Marvel being the pinnacle. And that, you know, yeah, Mary Jane is like, not a character, doesn't feel like a full character to me. I never thought like, whoa, she's cool. She's just a little bit dopey and she's always screaming and she's afraid of stuff. But I haven't read the comic book, so I don't know how.
This is all an homage to these 60s comics. These were comics for boys. They were by men for boys, about boys with girls as, you know, not much more than objects, and that was sort of how it all started. At least I'm simplifying it a little bit, but not a lot. Like there's a reason that they've had to work harder to get a better set of characters in modern movies, because it took the comic book industry a long time to really figure out that they needed to portray women differently, and that there could also be women who are audiences for their product, and that they should also be considered. And it, you know, the source material is a lot thinner on that score.
To be honest, Jason, I don't think you're simplifying it that much. I think that your assessment of that is tragically true, but that's the fact of history, right? So some things did better than others, but, you know, we have to be cognizant of what it was and where we are and what we need to improve, ultimately.
Yeah, I think some of the comics of the 60s and 70s made attempts, but the attempts would be failures by our standards today. But there were sometimes attempts to have better portrayals of women, but I think we would look at them now. Even something like Sue from the Fantastic Four, right? Like, by some standards of the 60s, it would be like, no, look, there's a woman who's a superhero and all of that. But yeah, but we look at it today and like, wow, that Sue Storm from the 60s was not good, right?
She was a house spouse with superpowers.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's move on to again, one of these funny kind of plot moments where it's like, next day, a building is on fire. And it's obviously, this is going to be a setup. This is more Green Goblin kind of nonsense. Although there's a great moment where there's a lady down there. She's, my baby's in there. And I always have that moment, which is like, why are you way downstairs, lady? And your baby is way up there. But anyway, Spider-Man comes and he's going to go save the baby. And he saves the baby and it's great. And then there's somebody else screaming and he's going to go back in. And the cop is there. And the cop's like, you know, you're wanted for being a vigilante. And he says, I'm going to go rescue that person. And he says, well, I'm going to be waiting for you down here. And one of my favorite lines in this movie, I've got to say, is Spider-Man just looks at the cop and goes, not coming back, chief. And then he swings away. It's great. It's like, I'm going to wait here, Spider-Man. You're going to return. He's like, no, that's not going to happen. So see you later.
I love that.
Not coming back,
chief. I love that so much.
It's so good.
Because it puts the choice on that guy.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, you're going to let me save the guy?
I'm going to go do this. What do you want? Yeah. What do you want to have happen?
Yeah. Sadly, it is followed by the worst line of dialogue in the entire movie, which is when they fight, the Green Goblin is there in ambush of Spider-Man and they fight. There is a great line by Spider-Man who he says, no, it is you who are out, Gobby, out of your mind. While the Power Rangers are fighting, that is the dialogue.
Here's the thing. The only way I can excuse that is that Peter is under high stress and he's just not that
not
funny.
Not his best material.
He's just not funny. Yes, well, the movie deserves better.
The movie deserves better. You know,
Peter Parker, 5 years from now, may be able to crack jokes. That guy is just like, he does not have it. He's not a Letterman yet.
There's an awkward Thanksgiving dinner where Norman proves again that he's an awful person. But they do go check Peter's room to see if Peter's home, and he's on the ceiling hiding. This is a thing that is referenced in Into the Spider-Verse kind of delightfully, where there are many spider people on the ceiling. We do see... at one point in this section of the movie, all of Norman Osborn's masks. He has many masks. We get it. Also, Peter has an interesting conversation with Mary Jane where she reveals that there is a man in her life that she likes way more than Harry. It's Spider-Man. And that leads to a scene that I wish was even funnier than it is, because it's painful, but I laugh every time that it happens. It's Peter recounting his whole conversation about Mary Jane that he had with Spider-Man. And it's this long, ridiculous speech about how great Mary Jane is. And I like to imagine that this is what Peter does when he's telling stories about Spider-Man. I like to imagine that he'll be like, hey, yeah, I talked to Spider-Man about you. Yeah, I said, hey, buddy. Hey, Spider-Man, how you doing? He said, hey, Peter, you're pretty cool. You're a cool guy. How's it going? I'm like, oh, no, you know, it's going pretty good. Fine, Spider-Man. How's it going with you? And the person is just sitting there going, oh, my God, kill me. Why is he talking like this? Because it's about as realistic as that, where he's like, yeah, I told Spider-Man all about you and how you inspire me to be a better person. And he said that was cool. And it's like, come on. Come on.
I was just saying to my friend Spider-Man, who's my friend, by the way.
Yeah. He's totally real. And we're buddies. And I take his picture because I'm kind of his photographer. And he was like, hey, Peter, you're my best friend. And I said, yeah, I like you too, Spider-Man.
So after, I don't know, what's it been, 10, 12 years of the MCU, I just wished he'd told the truth.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's where we've come, right?
I feel like that would... Yeah, I know. And in a way, at the time, I never felt that. I was like, okay, this is what he goes... He's, you know, he can't say he's Spider-Man.
They can't reveal their...
Yeah, in fact, his lesson at the end of this movie, which makes me so angry, and we'll get there momentarily.
I cannot give people their own agency and choice over how to live their lives.
Yeah, his lesson is, I can never... be near anyone because of this, because they will be harmed. And it's like, dude, your aunt was attacked. J. Jonah Jameson was attacked. Mary Jane was attacked. And this is your first month on the job. Like, this is your life now. Just deal with it. Like, I must pull away from society. Come on.
Turns out Tony Stark, dumb. Not a dummy.
Turns out.
No
dummy.
Yeah, you don't have to tell everybody, but you could tell.
No, I mean, maybe don't give away your address. That's dumb. But I mean, broadly.
Also, what are the chances that your roommate's dad is your first supervillain? Like, that's probably not going to happen again.
Right. That's,
I got a new roommate. It's Bobby Craven. I'm sure it's fine.
I love that you think that won't happen again, but guess what?
That's right.
The next time it was Michael Keaton. You do not want to mess with Michael Keaton.
Yeah, my dad is my roommate's dad is this magician. He goes by Mysterio. I'm sure it's not a problem.
It's fine. Everything's cool.
Peter Parker's roommate peril. That would be a story, right? Every roommate he gets, his parent is
Kurt Connors,
super villain.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Anybody he interacts with.
Bad
is
luck
bad.
For Peter Parker.
Yeah.
Also in this bit, Aunt May, who's recuperating at the hospital, she does tell Peter that he's not Superman again. That was in the trailer. That makes me laugh a lot too. That's a good bit.
Yeah. I like that too. Yeah. I always like when they cross reference each other. I don't know why. It's just cute. It's like, it's not like we don't know.
Spider-Man,
so just use it.
You're
you know?
No DC superhero.
Yeah, you're not Superman. You know, you got it. And he's like, yeah, Aunt May, sure. It's good. It's good.
But that's here's the thing.
She could say you're not Spider-Man, right? And he's like, nope, that's a little too on the nose.
Well, sure, but Superman is impeccable.
The best, yeah.
But saying that Peter isn't a Superman, or even Spider-Man isn't a Superman, is entirely true.
No, I agree.
Because guess what?
That's why
these
it's so
are
great.
All flawed characters, right? And so, I don't know. Just the notion's good. It fits with the character. It fits with the narrative. And more importantly, I think it tells the audience that, like, guess what? This character is going to screw up.
We go to the bridge, which is actually where Gwen Stacy died in the comic books. And that's the reference they're making here, even though this is Mary Jane. And we learn that when you're a superhero, eventually some lunatic is going to make you make a sadistic choice between two different groups to save. The difference between the Joker and the Dark Knight and the Green Goblin here is that the Green Goblin is not as good as his job, and he thinks that Spider-Man can't save both of them and says, ha-ha, you must choose between the Cub Scout troop in the Roosevelt Island tram or your girlfriend, and drops them both. And Peter's response is, oh, I'll just save them both. I can do that. You're not aware of how good I am, are you? I can do both of those things, which he does. And this is an ongoing thing for the Green Goblin, where he doesn't quite realize how good Spider-Man is at being Spider-Man, because he keeps assuming...
Are we sure that Spider-Man is as sure as he is?
Well, he may not be either, but he's proven right. It's like, you must choose between these two, and Peter does not choose. He saves them both.
Well, here's the thing. He saves MJ first,
sure,
and then goes to the kids.
Sure. Yeah, but he saves them too. It's like, oh, Norman, you gotta put the boats further apart.
My power moment for that was that he was willing to get cut down by the Goblin glider.
Yes, absolutely. Because then he's precarious.
Like it wasn't about catching them. It was like, okay, I can do that, and then, well, now I'm stuck.
Yeah, and that's a great.
I can't dodge. I can't do anything about it.
That's a good tension in that scene, is that he's got them both,
literally,
but
tension.
Now what do you do? And there's a barge he's trying to lower the kids in their tram to the barge, and he keeps getting hit, and he lets go, and he has to grab it again and do flips and all of that. And it's very tense. It's a good scene. I just think it's funny that it starts with this, you must make a choice, which the Joker will later, do in Dark Knight.
Right.
And the choice is very quickly just, I'll save both of them. It's like, good for you, Spider-Man. Just save both of them. It's not that hard, Green Goblin. I'll just do both.
Yeah, but what I like about it is the decision to save both of them is easy, and he does it. But the decision to stick to it
is hard.
Is difficult. Yeah.
You expect him to decide to save both of them. There's no other choice. But it should have been harder than that. Like, it shouldn't have been so, like, oh, you can actually grab both of them. Oh. You know, anyway, and I want to give a shout out to the bridge, because that is the 59th Street Bridge, also known as the Queensboro Bridge. And it isn't often the star of a scene compared to the Brooklyn Bridge or Verrazano.
Actually, since the last time I saw this movie, I've ridden the Roosevelt Island tram. So that's kind of fun, too.
Were you scared?
I was thinking of Spider-Man and the Green Goblin the whole time, actually.
Welcome to the Spider-Man peril tour of New York City.
Yeah, I feel like the Roosevelt Island tram is put in peril almost as much as the Golden Gate Bridge in movies. Like, it's a real convenient place to put people in peril. And if there were actual supervillains, they would not operate that tram. It's too dangerous. Too dangerous. Okay, big last fight in a ruined church. This is where they end up. It is Spider-Man versus the Green Goblin. And they fight, and there's a bomb, and Peter gets his mask blown off. And before the end, I want to mention, this is the part that actually bugged me the most in terms of how Mary Jane is treated. And it's subtext, but only barely. When the Green Goblin says that he is going to take care of Mary Jane after he kills Peter, he's going to finish her off nice and slow, and have a hell of a time. And I thought, that's pretty much a straight up rape threat at the hero's girlfriend. And that's too far for this movie.
Yeah.
But it's there.
A, it's too far. B, it's not congruent with the character as developed, who is a megalomaniac in terms of power, but not necessarily in terms of
I don't think he actually means it. I think he's just doing it to hurt him, if I want to analyze the Green Goblin. But it's gross.
Don't put that in your movie.
It's super gross.
It's not required. It's not good. It's
didn't like that at all.
And Spider-Man doesn't even choose to decide to kill him over it. He ultimately kills himself. Like, it's it's you don't need that. It should be cut. That's not a that.
Well,
we don't need that.
It did give him the turnaround moment where he was losing the fight, and then there's let's turn on the adrenaline because Mary Jane is yet again in danger in theory. And I don't think he had to say, as Jason said, make it all have this sexual overtones. It just could have been after I'm done with you, I'm gonna drop Mary Jane off the bridge.
Yeah, and I'll kill your aunt and all of those things, okay. Right?
Yeah, Skinner alive, even. Like, anything that didn't, which is bad, obviously don't do that, but...
But it is, here are these characters, they only exist to motivate you to fight me.
I'd like to think that we came a long way in the past 18 years, but probably not.
Yeah, I think in some cases we have, because I think this stops us now in a way that it didn't stop us in 2002. I will also say that, you know, Sam Raimi seems to me to be an embracer of kind of schlock as reference point. And I think he thinks big, broad moves like this and like some of the stuff in the wrestling sequence. I feel like that's just kind of one of the colors he paints with. And I don't particularly like it, but I get that he's coming from a place with a lot of his other movies where everything is super heightened and broad and anything goes, and it's all like gross and ridiculous. And in Darkman or in Evil Dead, you're going to get that. And in Spider-Man, you know, he brings that sensibility, and it's not quite the same, but he brings that sensibility. And there are a couple of places where I'm like, maybe not the right tone for this movie, but I get maybe where you got that move because you're Sam Raimi and you made these other movies that are where it was maybe, I don't want to say appropriate, but like maybe more tonally consistent with that kind of movie than it is for a superhero movie.
Yeah, I agree. Specifically, I agree with your metaphor of picking paint colors to set a scene with. I don't particularly like the color that he uses,
right, yeah.
I don't necessarily... not appreciate what he was trying to do. You know, I can't advocate for it necessarily in many ways, but I get it. And it's totally consistent with what he wanted to create. It's certainly not meant to be intentionally harmful.
I was going
to
say more like it's a blind spot.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Blind spot.
This is just one of the moves that he makes. And in this movie, it stands out even more than it might stand out in some kind of over the top horror movie. Yeah.
Right. Because it's Spider-Man. He's Spider-Man is like the ultimate, like, oh, gee, shucks, I'm going to try to do the best thing kind of guy. So
the culmination of the fight scene is actually going back to my point about how Norman Osborn doesn't really know all of Spider-Man's moves. The key moment in this fight scene, and I think it's very clever, is that he is talking. He's going to use his like Norman Osborn voice to say, oh, thank God for you. You're taking care of this. And I'm so sorry, Peter, and all that. And meanwhile, he's using his remote control to get the Goblin glider with its knives or whatever, its Ginsu knife attachments ready. And he's going to ram them through Peter and kill him. What he doesn't know is that spider sense is a thing. And the spider sense is the thing that kills him because Peter jumps out of the way. And in a hilarious moment to this day, I laugh and laugh and laugh, is there's that moment where he realizes that he's going to be impaled by the Goblin glider and goes, oh. and then he's impaled and he dies. And with his last word, just planting another seed, he says, don't tell Harry, which is like, oh, because then that sets up all this other, it poisons his best friend's relationship with Spider-Man, right? Which he is Spider-Man, and it creates a whole new thing.
Is that intentional? Does he mean it in that, like, don't let me, don't let him know?
I think it's shame, but... either way, it his motivation, that last thing before it says before he dies totally screws Peter over, right?
Yeah, well, he's an egotistical mega industrialist. All he cares about is his own legacy, and whether he thinks Peter will do as instructed or not, with his last words, that is what he cares about.
Yep.
I do kind of laugh every time I see that because he gets impaled in the hips.
Yeah, right. It goes right through his thighs or something. It's like it's not exactly.
Yeah, it's a weird shot. It's like, yeah.
I'm sure he'll slowly die.
Maybe you could be okay.
You know, maybe it's stabbed through and cut his femoral artery or something.
Yeah, but believe me, I'm not going to guess what a Ginsu knife attached to a flying glider is going to do to you. But
it was awfully low. It was a low blow.
Bit weird.
It was a low blow.
A little low. Yeah,
he was gutted. That O of realization though is so funny because it's such a weird choice. And I'm gonna give Sam Raimi the credit. Is tone wise, it's just so strange and yet it is delightful. It's the moment where the villain realizes, oh no, I lose. Yeah. It's like it's great.
I do like
it's
that.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. So after dropping off Norman's dead body. Impaled at the hips, back not too worse for wear on a sheet on a lounge chair and Harry seeing him and saying Spider-Man will pay. We get to the last scene, which is there's the Norman Osborn funeral. There's a long voiceover. The ones I love will be the ones who pay, says Peter. Mary Jane says she was thinking of Peter and that on the bridge and that she's the one that he's the one that she realizes cares about her, which is, I would say, kind of a long way to go and kind of okay. I think this ending is terrible. I'll just put it that way. She suddenly realizes that she's in love with Peter and that Peter loves her, which comes out of nowhere and is not supported in the rest of the movie. Peter then rejects her and says, I can't. I'll always be your friend, but that's all I have to give. And then he goes back to his voiceover. I get what they're trying to do, which is poor sad sack Peter Parker can't catch a break. What I want to have this ending be is that Mary Jane maybe has a hint of realization that maybe Peter is Spider-Man, right, and that maybe Peter is who she's interested after all, and that Peter is unclear about where they're going from here because he's in this weird position where all of this stuff is going on, and we leave it in sort of a precarious place of like, I might be optimistic, but I wonder what's happening next and what threat is around the corner. What we get is a sudden conversion by MJ, a super immediate rejection by Peter, and a sad sack voiceover where he says, I can never love anybody. The end. And it's like, what are you doing? So that's...
Well, Jason, Mary Jane obviously hasn't been allowed enough agency to have that kind of realization and be that smart. Not in this movie is she allowed to have those kinds of independent thoughts. All she's allowed to do is be in love with a boy. That's it.
How does everybody else feel about the ending of this movie now that I've just laid my cards on the table?
It makes me so angry. I folded because you had the better hand.
It was frustrating. I didn't remember the end, you know, and so, I don't think I have actually watched this movie since 2002, but I thought, oh, you know, she gets to say it's him that she loves and now he's going to be happy. And the way that he, you know, the way that they wrote that where he's like, it wasn't even very tortured. I don't know. It was just like kind of cold and he left her like.
Yeah. Lack of affect at all.
You know, I think about Harry Potter and how he had to say, like, I can't hang out, you know, with Ginny because, you know, Voldemort's always after me. I can't really, you know, everybody's in danger if they're with me, you know, but it was passionate. And that was just very like, it was weird.
I'm going to make your decisions for you, little lady.
I almost wanted it to be that she confesses that he's been there for her all along and kisses him and then has this weird, awkward moment where she's like, are you? And he's like, this is super strange. I mean, there are so many ways they could do this where it was sort of like all up in the air, and instead it's like this weird, like, her profession of love followed by him like turning her down after this whole movie and saying I can never love anyone ever again because I'm Spider-Man, pity me. It's just like I don't know, it bugs me. Guy, how are you feeling about the end of this movie?
It's just wrong.
Are we wrong to want at least the possibility of happiness for these characters?
No. Here's the thing, I don't inherently believe the end of this movie. I don't think that the relationship between MJ and Peter is resolved. It feels hackneyed and just tacked on. I don't believe Peter's motivation to not talk to her about what happened. I don't even believe Peter's motivation to not tell her that he's Spider-Man.
You say tacked on. I think you're right, and I don't have any... I haven't seen drafts of this movie, but it feels tacked on. It feels like this was not how the movie was supposed to end.
By the end of this movie, the Peter Parker character should have had the courage to tell Mary Jane that he loved her and that he was Spider-Man. That's it. That's all. That's what should have happened. I don't know. You could end it like that, like Iron Man did. I am Iron Man or I am Spider-Man. You could have done it.
Oh, you could have left it ambiguous, right?
Yeah.
That's my pitch, is that she kisses him and there's a look and it's like, does she figure it out? Does he know that she knows? And then we don't know whether it's known or not.
They could still leave us hanging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
on a web.
I take that too. But as it ended, there was we didn't leave with the ambiguity that was deserved after having watched the whole movie.
Peter's a jerk to her at the end, and his voiceover basically says, "Hey, don't blame me for being a jerk. I have to be a jerk because I care." It's like, no, you don't. You're a jerk.
Here's the thing. He could have been a jerk because he cared, but he didn't earn it in this movie.
Yeah.
At the end of this movie, you want him to be spectacular, amazing, sensational, one of those adjectives that have been attached to titles of the comics. You don't want him to be the jerktastic Spider-Man. And that's exactly what he is.
Yeah. I just want to be honest.
And then we get that amazing sequence where we see him kind of in full Spider-Man mode, swinging on the rooftop, swinging through the streets of Manhattan and up onto the rooftop. And it's a great kind of like final moment, pump your fist, you know, in the air. Yay, it's a Spider-Man movie. And that is tonally completely disconnected with the scene that comes before it, too. So it's like, what are you doing?
You need to earn that joy. And you need to earn that joy by through the liberation of honesty, I feel. And I don't know how you can go swinging through the city, you know, happiness in hand, while carrying the weight of that funeral scene with you. It's a bit of a break, I feel.
You know, if you lifted out the funeral scene and you followed the leaving Norman Osborn's body with the, you know, swinging through the city thing at the end, that it still is an ill fit, but it's not as ill fitting because we're changing tones four times in the last four scenes. In a way that just feels incredibly disjointed.
So final thoughts about this movie. We've talked a lot about its flaws. I think we've also talked about the positive things about it. Like I said, I was relieved because I was worried that I was going to revisit this and it was going to disappoint me because I've seen so many newer, more modern takes on Spider-Man recently. And I was actually quite happy with it. It has a lot of great moments. It does have its flaws, some of which were apparent at the time, some of which have become apparent over the last 17 years. But all in all, I thought pretty fun movie. How did everybody else feel? Gene, how did you feel in revisiting this?
I was pleasantly surprised that I liked it as much as I remember liking it the first time. And it's sort of parallel with like last summer when we revisited the first Iron Man, which I went to see also knowing nothing about Iron Man and being like, that movie was pretty kick-ass, like, and to come back and say 10 years later and say like, yeah, it's still, you know. And so I definitely, if somebody's like me and you haven't watched this in a long time, I will be telling people, you know, or maybe with my nieces and nephews, like who probably haven't seen it, like say like, let's go back, you know, to Spider-Man before the Spider-Man that you know, and see when a grown-up, really nerdy, not as cute guy played Spider-Man. So,
Guy,
this is a good movie. I think Spider-Man 2 is better.
Yeah, we'll get there in the summer of Spider-Man.
I'm not trying to reach ahead. There's more better Spider-Man movies, but here's the thing: this is the first Spider-Man movie that I saw that I loved.
For sure.
This was an amazing movie. It blew my mind. This was one of the first movies that made me convinced that superhero movies would actually be a worthwhile thing to watch. There are things about it that I don't appreciate or I don't think that have aged well, but ultimately I think that they are in service of a character born of the 60s and that these filmmakers have not yet figured out how to take that sensibility and bring it into the modern era, which I don't think for Spider-Man landed until the Homecoming. Really, Spider-Man 2 maybe. And this, as an early experiment, I think is very, very strong, including the weird overlays of the goblin tripping balls doing weird stuff. Like all of it is kind of screwed up. There's some weird visual effects, especially during the intro and some like when he gets bitten by a spider. That's just a trippy video effect. What's that doing in a mainstream movie? I don't know, but it's cool. It's right there, and I dig it. I am glad that it exists, and I would recommend it to anybody that would like to see a formative Spider-Man movie that is maybe not be quite the MCU, but certainly informs what the MCU would become.
Great. Moises?
You know, this is a good movie, and I think we contextualized its place in comic book movie history really well. There are a lot of things that it pioneered, and it definitely deserves praise in that context. There are those who have said things about the current MCU iteration of Spider-Man not representing the true version of Spider-Man on the comic page. For those people who want to live in 1962 for the rest of their lives,
I give you Spider-Man 2002.
I give you Spider-Man 2002 because you get as close to that as you are going to get in terms of the direct characterization of the early Lee Ditko Spider-Man work. Nobody is going to get closer to it than this movie did. But that doesn't mean that one should excuse things like we had during the wrestling match. We had it come out of Spider-Man's mouth, effectively a gay joke against his antagonist. And that's not okay. I, like Jason, was worried going into revisiting it that it was going to have more issues like that than it ended up having. And that was a relief to me because I had a pretty fond memory of this movie. Like Guy said earlier, I have a fonder memory of Spider-Man 2, but it was nice seeing the things that they did that did push the ball forward. There's a lot that this movie deserves credit for, but I equally think it's not right to give a free pass to things that should be called out for what they are as not okay.
Yeah, I think that's fair. This turns out to be a good movie with some issues. And I would argue that even in 2002, it was a good movie with issues. And then with 17 years removed, we can see some of the other issues even more clearly. I would say, I mean, it's also been, you know, modern superheroes, like they've had two other chances to tell Spider-Man stories in terms of resetting and casting new characters. And it is easy to kind of say the Sam Raimi movies are trying to do the classic original Spider-Man. Amazing Spider-Man films were a very ultimate Spider-Man, Brian Michael Bendis, strangely telling stories in around the time that the Spider-Man movie came out that we just talked about. But then that fed into those later movies. And then the current take, and one of the things I love about the Tom Holland Spider-Man and the current take in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is it is a totally new, modern take on Spider-Man. And I'm one of those Spider-Man fans who thinks it's great when you're calling back to the classics, but I also think it's great when I want to see a new take that is filtered for modern audiences through modern eyes. And the Tom Holland Spider-Man does that, and it's delightful. And so I think, you know, having these different kinds of Spider-Man story being told across time is great. And even though it's been 17 years, yes, we have had what is it? Seven Spider-Man movies, eight if you count seven live action. Into the Spider-Verse would make it eight, and that would be four distinct takes in 17 years on Spider-Man across eight movies.
Jason, I think you and I both enjoy Spider-Man as a angsty teenager. I think that broadly what we came up with when we were young.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer is my favorite TV show of all time, and Joss Whedon has said very clearly he's doing Spider-Man. That's like, that was the whole point, right? Is it's angsty teenager with powers, and the powers ruin her life in the gender flipped version in Buffy. Yeah,
exactly. And the fact that we've had three to four distinct takes on Spider-Man over the 30 to 40 years that we've been following the character may seem weird to a lot of people, but if we step back and think about it, I think that makes a bit of sense, right? Like, we've had basically one per generation, just like the Slayer.
And Sam Raimi wanted to do a nostalgia trip kind of thing and felt like, let's get to the core of the character. And I think that's not a bad thing for him to have done, even though from this vantage point I look at it and say, wow, this is sort of set in an almost 60s version of 2000, and that's a little bit weird, but I get why he wanted to do it, because, you know, seeing Jonah and Betty and Robbie and the Daily Bugle on screen in a movie is a lot of fun, even though that does not work in today's context, and even in 2002 was shaky.
No, it worked for us when we were of the age to buy the most tickets.
Exactly. All right, we will wrap it up there. Thank you to everybody for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. I want to thank my panelist, Guy English. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's always a thrill to be here, and thwip, thwip, thwip.
G. McDonald, thank you.
Thank you.
And Moises Chuyan, with great power comes great responsibility.
Oh, no, 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 Jason. I got you for 3 minutes.
Bonesaw. And thanks to everybody out there once again. We will see you next week with more of The Summer of Spider-Man.